From the studios of Ave Maria Radio in Ann Arbor, this is Veterans Radio. And now, here's your host, Dale Thronberry.
And good morning, America, and welcome to Veterans Radio. It is our privilege and honor to be here every week to tell you the stories of America's veterans. And joining me today is our air boss.
Air boss today. Nina's Bob got the Gould. Time off right now.
Yeah, 101st Airborne, Bob Gould. Good morning, Bob.
You know, good morning, everybody out there. I'm on the board. I'm the board guy. Air boss today. The
ready
board.
To go. And also, our social media expert, Maria Radu, is on Facebook and Twitter right now, and you can find us there at Veterans Radio at either one of those sites. That's Veterans Radio Facebook.
I could watch her.
I know. You know, we're getting so computer and so technologically savvy.
It's way cool, because this was hard this morning for her to be here, but she's here. That's way cool.
I have
way
to point out that Maria is also the editor of, the local college paper and a lot of other things. So we greatly appreciate the effort that she puts forth in getting up early every Saturday morning and helping us out.
Helping the veterans, too, I want to say. This is helping the veterans.
Oh, absolutely.
She's a veteran advocate.
She is, and this is what we all are here, of course. And of all of you out there as listeners, we know that you are as well. We've got a couple of announcements that we want to make today before we get into our program, and I guess I should preface it that today is an encore presentation of a program we did back in October of 2008 with Bing West. And Bing West was the author of a book called The Strongest Tribe. And after we play the program from 2008, Bing is going to be on the program a little bit later on to review what has happened in the last 5 years, not only in Afghanistan, but also in Syria and the Middle East. He is an expert, former Assistant Secretary of Defense under the Reagan administration, and also a Marine veteran. So we encourage you to stay tuned to the program and especially listen to the pre-recorded part of our program. And don't call in then, but hold your calls till the second half of the program, and Bing will be more than happy to answer them at that time. So, the events that were coming up.
Yes.
First one I want to talk about is a local event happening over in Ypsilanti at the Sidetrack restaurant in Depot Town. There's going to be a fundraiser there for the SAS project, and the SAS happens to stand for Sports Afield and Stream for Warriors. And this is an organization that takes veterans of the Iraq-Afghanistan Wars, or OIF, and the other acronyms that I can't remember off the top of my head right now, but most of them are wounded and recovering veterans, and they take them out and they take them fishing, or they take them skiing, or they take them mountain climbing. It's a great organization, and another local organization is sponsoring this dinner at the Sidetrack Cafe on Monday the 23rd from 5:30. Starting at 5:30, and that's Operation Never Forgotten. And Operation Never Forgotten are the people that put these billboards around airports and so forth, showing veterans coming home and so forth, so we don't forget that these men and women are out there protecting us all around the world. And Operation Never Forgotten is a sponsor of this at the Sidetrack, and 50% of all of the proceeds that for whatever you buy for dinner, for meal or drink or anything at the Sidetrack there will be going to the SAS project. And the waiters and waitresses have agreed to donate all of their tips. This is really cool. And, you know, the way America responds to our veterans is amazing when we think about it. And so we encourage everybody to go over to the Sidetrack Cafe on Monday the 23rd. And it's 5:30 to 9 o'clock at Depot Town Sidetrack. Just go in, 50% of the profits, all of the tips go to this operations SAS project, Sports Afield and Stream for Warriors.
And they're going to have an auction at 7 o'clock.
Memorabilia.
Yes.
And
yeah, they're going to have a lot of stuff.
And there's entertainment, which I forgot to mention. The music by Stacey Mason, former Miss Michigan, is going to be there performing. So live music, great food, great atmosphere, lots of veterans. Come on down.
You know, there's a lot of these things that happen all over the country. Mm-hmm. So we encourage all of you listeners out there to go online, go to your VA. That's one avenue of information. Where else, Dale, can they...
We can probably just put down veterans events wherever you happen
to
be.
Google that and all kinds of things
come up. All kinds of stuff came up, because I think I got something for California, but I got it a couple of days late. But, you know, they're out there, so let us know, and we'll be happy to talk about them on the air.
Mm-hmm. Talk
and
to
Bob,
the
you had something else that's very important coming up this week.
Well, it's very close to my heart, too, because I have experience of this in my family. September is Suicide Month, and it's a yearly event or a yearly outreach, there we go, that the VA, the Veterans Administration, the Veterans Health System, is making aware that there is a Veterans Crisis Line, somebody who is in stress. I don't like to say trouble. I like to say stress. People that are being stressed, because sometimes you just don't know when it overwhelms you and suicide takes hold. The suicide prevention outreach programs that came from the VA started in 2007. At that time, veterans were committing suicide at 18 per day in 2007. So here we are 6 years later, and now it's up to 22 per day. And those are just the ones that are being reported. So since its launch in 2007, the Veterans Crisis Line, they've received, Dale, over 814,000 calls and 28,000 rescues. Now that's just the ones that made the phone call, okay? So all you folks out there, by the way, whenever you listen to Veterans Radio, always have a pen, paper, pencil, because we come up with such good stuff. The Veterans Crisis Line is 800-273-8255. 800-273-8255. It's confidential, and it does save lives.
It's important, and that's what we're all about. We've got to help these men and women. You know, sometimes they've been exposed to stuff that we can't even imagine. So we want to make sure that we can help them out. I want to, we're going to get right into our interview right now with Bing West, but we need to kind of preface this a little bit. Prior to our talking with Bing back in October of 2008, he was listening before he went on the air. And first of all, Bob wanted to know where the name Bing came from. So I'm not going to tell you right now, but it's in the first part of the interview where the name Bing came from. And then the second part that Bing refers to is that we just did a live read commercial about our local Big Boy restaurant. And, of course, you know, Bob goes on about what great food and service and so on is going on over there. And so you'll hear this in the first part of the interview. So we're going to take a real quick break for the Marine Scholars, and then we'll be coming back with our interview from October of 2008 with Bing West. Hold your calls until the second half of the program, and he will be back on the program live at that time. Okay, Robert, you're on.
You have honorably served the United States and the Marine Corps in times of peace and war. Now we would like to serve you. The Marine Scholars Program covers the total cost of attending Ave Maria University. By combining resources from the Ave Maria University Marine Scholars Funding, federal financial aid entitlements, and the GI Bill, the benefits are granted for the duration of the recipient's study at Ave Maria University, contingent upon good conduct and good academic standing. The Marine Scholars Program is open to all reserve and active component Marines and other combat veterans of Operation Enduring Freedom and Operation Iraqi Freedom who have honorably served our country. Please visit us online at www.avemaria.edu or call the Assistant Director of Admissions at 239-280-2552. You helped us. Now let us help you. Semper Fi.
We're back on Veterans Radio, and we're going to be talking with author Bing West in just a moment, but I want to read something from the cover of his book. It says, during the fierce battle for Fallujah, Bing West asked an Iraqi colonel why the arch-terrorist Abu Musab al-Zarqawi had fled in women's clothes. The colonel pointed to a Marine patrol walking by and said, you Americans are the strongest tribe. Bing West, I want to welcome you to Veterans Radio.
Thank you, Dale. I was about to go out to Big Boys and get breakfast after what Bob had to say about how mouth-watering it was, but I thought I owed him an explanation for the name Bing.
Okay.
Coming from the Marines to the 101st. And it happens that you were dead on. It was Bing Crosby, and I was born in 1940, way back when he had just made the Bells of St. Mary's, and he was Father O'Brien. And my aunt, Sister Bunny, she's of the St. Joseph Order, heard that I had red hair, and it was born on his birthday, and said, oh, you have to name him Bing. And I've been grateful for Sister Bunny ever since, because otherwise I would have had to go through life known as Francis or Franny.
Oh,
so
no.
Sister Bunny did me a wonderful favor by nicknaming me Bing.
Thank you, Bing. Thank you very much.
Well, I appreciate that, and it's great to be talking to you. I really enjoyed reading your book, The Strongest Tribe, subtitled War Politics and the End Game in Iraq. I want to remind our audience that Bing is a Marine. He was in Vietnam, it looked like, more than one time, weren't you?
Yeah, I was with the Combined Action Platoons over there and also force recon some of the other units, typical grunt.
And then you also served in the Reagan administration.
Right.
As undersecretary of...
As assistant secretary
assistant
of
secretary, excuse me,
international security affairs.
Okay. We're not going to talk about the right or wrong of, what's going on in Iraq, but I would like to talk a little bit about the history of what occurred once we were there, because this is really one of the main issues that you have with the way that the war was, not instigated, but conducted, let's put it that way. Tell me a little bit about what you saw as some of the mistakes that were made once we got in.
Well, I've been there 16 times, and I've been embedded with about 70 of the different units. And, I've talked to maybe 2,000 or 4,000 soldiers and Marines and everybody all the way up to the White House and down to the corporal. And it was pretty clear that what happened when we first got in there, we were looking for weapons of mass destruction. Now, I think that was a reasonable thing to do because it wasn't just the United States. The entire world believed that Saddam had chemical weapons and may have biological weapons.
Right.
And we went in right after 9/11 where we had 3,000 Americans killed here in New York City. And so the attitude of the country then was we could get hit again. Saddam is a nutcase. He's a murderer. He tried to kill President H.W. Bush tried to assassinate him. We had no reason to believe that if he had weapons of mass destruction, he would not give them eventually to some terrorist. So we go in to throw him out. But the problem was once we were there, we had kicked over a beehive, and that was that the Shiites, who were the minority, about 15 million Iraqis, now were liberated. And President Bush said, I'm going to give you democracy. Well, that meant they would be in charge by a majority against the Sunnis who had been oppressing them for 400 years. And so the Sunnis, when this happened, felt they were totally disenfranchised. And the big mistake we made was Ambassador Bremer threw out the Iraqi army, just threw it away. But
right.
when we threw it away, we had to take over the country at a time when the Sunnis felt that we had kicked them out of power. So the Sunnis rebelled against us.
Right. And if you get an opportunity to read Bing West's book, and I strongly suggest it, with The Strongest Tribe, you talk about in there the idea of that the Shias were suddenly in power and that a lot of their leaders actually had left the country and now we're coming back to take over. And it's almost like they went back into the old neighborhoods and started pushing the Sunnis further and further away from, their homes.
Oh, they did. They were hostile to the Sunnis, and the Sunnis were saying, well, what's in this for us? And our big mistake was we hadn't thought it through. We didn't have the right kind of government. And no one was listening to the military.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's the thing that drove me bananas over there, was that Ambassador Bremer, whom we had put in charge, spoke only to the president and ignored the military. I mean, Ambassador Bremer was very arrogant. And it was only our military that was out in the cities. And we could have avoided a lot of this, Dale, because, in the summer of 2003, our battalion commanders, average age 42, were in charge of cities of hundreds of thousands, in some cases millions, of Iraqis, all of whom looked up to them because they were the conquerors. They were the ones who had come in and swept out Saddam.
Right.
They would do anything we told them to do, and the first thing our battalion commander said was, well, let's have local elections. And guess what? In Najaf and in Karbala, down in the south, the city council's turned around and said, "Yeah, we're going to elect you."
Yeah, yeah.
And he said, "No, we're not going to be. You have to elect one of your own." And Brema said, "No, we're not going to have local elections." And it was a shame because we could have organized that country, but we didn't do it. And as a result, the Sunnis said, "Well, we're going to rebel."
Right, which opened the door for al-Qaeda to come in.
Exactly. And al-Qaeda came in, and religion had a lot to do with that.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there is a virulent strain of Islam that I don't care what anyone says, that it is filled with hate, and they had a lot of their imams who were saying, you have to rise up in jihad against the infidel invaders. And they put this religious overlay of hate on top of a cauldron that was boiling with political resentments. And I used to listen with the Marines on the rooftops in Fallujah and other places, night after night, to the call to arms that was going out from the mosques. And I couldn't understand why we were allowing such sedition to go on. And people were saying, well, you know, that's a religion. But what we missed was that when al-Qaeda came in, they twisted the religion and used it as a weapon of hate. And then what al-Qaeda began to do is to send car bombs into the Shiite areas and blow up and murder hundreds of Shiites. So then the Shiites became very, very antagonistic, as you'd imagine, and fearful and angry toward the Sunnis. So al-Qaeda was able to light this fuse of sectarian fighting and that eventually led to a civil war.
It's just amazing how you were able to document all of these things. And I think as we were watching it, let me back up for a second. You mentioned how mad you were at the beginning in 2003, and I've talked to an awful lot of veterans since that time period, and we all were angry. We couldn't figure out what we were mad at.
We knew what we were angry at.
Yeah, I know, but I mean, it's like, why am I, you know, I'm mad all the time. And then we started making these comparisons, between Vietnam and Iraq. And there are some, I believe, that were going on. And we're going, oh, this is why we're mad, because we're not doing what we know we should be doing. And
that's correct. We weren't doing it on two parts. First, you take the 101st, Bob, or you take the Marines, and you put them in a situation, and you say, you're here to win. And, you know, the reason we have tough infantry is because they're tough infantry. But the problem was, once there was no organized enemy, we hadn't changed the mindsets of our soldiers and Marines. So we were storming around the countryside looking for this elusive insurgent, and there weren't that many of them, and they were in civilian clothes. Well, when you burst into houses at 2 o'clock in the morning and scare the living daylights out of everybody, you're not making friends. So our military, it took them a while to change, and it took a while for the doctrine to say, hey, guys, we're no longer fighting an organized military. You have to think in terms of winning these people over and treat them like you treat the people in your own neighborhood back home.
Mm-hmm.
That was one thing that had to change.
Yeah, it's winning the hearts and minds.
Pardon me?
Winning the hearts and minds.
Correct. And the other thing that basically had to change was, and this is where things got very confused, why were we there?
Mm-hmm.
Well, our military always believed, and I document this and I show that from 2003 through 2006, our military believed they were there, not to win, but to stand up enough Iraqis to take care of their own problems and we get out. President
mm-hmm.
Bush believed we were there for victory, however he was defining it, and that we, our soldiers, were going to achieve that victory. And that was never resolved at the White House level until the end of 2006 with what they called the surge. I mean, it was very, very surprising. The White House never had a let's all sit down and understand if we're on the same page, and we weren't. Our military just wanted to turn the war over and let the Iraqis sort it out. President Bush wanted our military to win.
Right, and then you mentioned in your book about a lot of these meetings that were going on during the 2003 and 2004 and to the lead up to the surge eventually and how they went through all these different philosophies. We've only got about 45 seconds before our first break, Bing, and so I want to kind of hold that thought. I want to talk about, you know, who instigated the idea of the surge, and I think some people are going to be surprised when they find out who supported what and how that went along. I was very interested. I learned a lot from reading this. I'm talking with Bing West, the author of the book called The Strongest Tribe. Okay, you are listening to a pre-recorded interview that we did back in October 18th of 2008 with Bing West. Bob and I have decided that with the 10th anniversary of Veterans Radio coming up, that we're going to play some of our favorite programs. And so we're going to encourage you to contact us with your favorite programs, and we'll try to replay some of those. Today's interview is with Bing West. As we mentioned, his book is The Strongest Tribe, and we're going to ask you to hold your calls. And, Bob, you want to say something?
Yeah, 10 years with the wrong woman. who sang that? Was that Lefty Frizzell?
I do not know. You are the expert on that type of music. But, yes, 10 years is a lot. You know, we've been on the air for 10 years, and that's a pretty amazing record, in its own right.
Oh, absolutely.
And of course, we couldn't do it without you, our listeners out there, and we want to thank you all.
And DEO.
And especially WDEO. Where we are broadcasting today, you're listening to Veterans Radio on WDEO 990 AM in Ann Arbor, WMAX in Saginaw, Michigan, and WDEO FM in Naples, Florida. And at other various places around the world at veteransradio.net. We're going to go back and rejoin our interview with Bing West right now. Hold your calls until our pre-recorded part of the program is over, and we'll be talking with Bing live in about 20 minutes. And we're back on Veterans Radio. We're talking with Bing West, author of The Strongest Tribe, which talks about the war in Iraq and the lead-up to the surge. And, Bing, I wanted to ask you just quickly about the change in attitude that occurred in, say, 2004, 2005, when everything seemed to be going down the tubes and, you know, in chaos.
The dilemma was pretty clear pretty fast that there were always two different wars that were being fought in Iraq, and they were as different as the Pacific versus the Atlantic theaters in World War II. And most people didn't realize this was happening in Iraq, and a lot of our commanders didn't. You had out west the Anbar province war that accounted for 40% of our casualties. That quickly became a straight-up fight between the Sunni tribes organized by al-Qaeda and the Marines and the Army soldiers out in the west. Then in the east, you had an entirely different dynamic. Out west, there were no Shiites, there were no Kurds. It was straight, angry Sunnis. In the east, it was around Baghdad, it was a majority of Shiites and a minority of Sunnis. So in the east in 2004 and 2005, it seemed that there was less fighting, and there was. And so our forces there pulled back to the bases because they thought things were peaceful. What we didn't realize in the east, because our military couldn't work with the police.
Right.
But the U.S. Congress made it against the law for the United States military to be involved with police forces because our Congress had this ideology going back to the late 1970s with El Salvador and Central America that the army was a force of evil inside countries. And therefore, they said our army could not help another army in internal defense. That had to be a police matter that the State Department would do. So as a result, we had no linkages between our army in the midst of an insurgency and the Iraqi police, who were basically Shiite.
Right.
So what was happening, and we didn't know it, in Baghdad and those areas, was that the police, the Shiite police, were working with the Shiite militia and getting organized. And they were getting more and more angry at the car bombs of al-Qaeda that were killing Shiites. And we didn't see this because our military wasn't working with them. We were back on the bases. The fight was out in the west, the famous battles of Fallujah, etc.,
right,
which was a straight stand-up between the Americans against the Sunni tribes and al-Qaeda. That was the situation in 2004 and 2005.
And it just seemed to continually go downhill. Talking with many Iraqi veterans that we have on this program is that they were saying how they didn't plan on being military police. And we ended up doing quite a bit of that.
The biggest problem, and it's going to be with us for the 21st century, the huge shift that occurred in Iraq and now has occurred in Afghanistan and will continue. Just think of it. Every single veteran listening to me, he understands one thing. When he enters the military, he puts on a uniform, and he fights somebody else in a uniform. That was the industrial age of the 20th century. In the 21st century, the way our enemies fight us is they don't put on a uniform. And so they're standing right in front of you among the civilians. And the big problem is, how do you know who he is? If he put on a uniform, you could take care of him very quickly.
Right.
Without a uniform, you force our military to become policemen. They're trying to do the police identification task, and we're not trained to do it. We have no training in our background to do that mission.
Right.
So our soldiers were very frustrated. I mean, morale was really low in 2004 and 2005, 2006 for good reasons, because we didn't know how to fight. And we felt we felt handcuffed, and we felt every time we got some of these insurgents and arrested them, they were let go again. And that's true.
I was going to say, we weren't necessarily getting the cooperation that we needed from the Iraqi government.
No, not at all. The Iraqi government then and now was playing games with us, and they would allow Sunnis to be arrested, but not Shiites. And what happened, though, that was the bad news story. And it seemed like al-Qaeda really had control out in the West among the Sunnis, and the militia had control among the Shiites. At that point, you have to say, holy smokes. But what we didn't know was that while we were talking every single day with the Sunni sheikhs, every day you'd meet with them, and many times they tell you they were the resistance.
Mm-hmm.
And what gradually happened is that the Sunnis saw that the al-Qaeda types among them, when they had a dispute with them, they'd kill the Sunni sheikhs. And then if they saw a good-looking woman, they'd say, I want to marry her, and they'd take the woman. And gradually the Sunnis realized, my gosh, these guys who came in saying that they were all for jihad, etc., they turned out to be the mafia. And once they got control, they were ruthless. And the Americans were consistently saying to the Sunnis, why are you fighting us? Why are you doing it? You know, we don't get it. All we want to do is get things settled down and go back to our own country.
Mm-hmm.
Finally, that message got through, and we didn't even know it was getting through. And I try to point out in my book, that was the fascinating thing that I found, is that the war had already shifted for the good at the time when it looked most black here back in the United States and in Washington. So when it seemed to be midnight in Washington, you know, oh my goodness, there'll never be any dawn. Dawn had already risen out in the West in Anbar because the Sunnis themselves had said, we've had enough of al-Qaeda. We're going to shift sides and go over to the Americans.
Right, and you point that out in your book, and we're talking again with Bing West, and his book is called The Strongest Tribe, which I found to be a really appropriate title. Because the whole system over there is tribal, and we probably still don't thoroughly understand it, but we certainly didn't understand it when we first got there.
We certainly didn't, and we tried to impose a democratic system when they weren't ready for it. And as a result, we have some people in there as the supposed elected people who are the wrong people, and it's going to take a while to unscramble that. But we gradually got to understand these tribes. And once the tribes came over, and this was before the famous surge, the war actually was over or had critically turned before President Bush ever began with the surge. That was pretty ironic, and a couple of members of his staff knew it, especially this guy Hadley, who was the National Security Council advisor. He had sent out some of his people, and they had come back and told him in November of 06, they said, you know, things are actually looking up out in the West where al-Qaeda supposedly is in charge because the people are beginning to rebel against al-Qaeda. And so by the time that President Bush announced the surge in January 2007, and sent over General Petraeus in February of 2007, the war had already turned. And the brilliance of Petraeus was the first week that he was in office out there, he flew out to Anbar and saw that the war was over out there and said to his staff, hey, let's do this everywhere. Any of the Sunnis that want to come over, let's pay them. They can have their own neighborhood watches. And then he said, and you know, this thing about us being back on the bases in Baghdad when they're all out here in Anbar and small patrols, we're going to go back to small patrols. And so he sent, he called it, don't commute to work. So right. He told all the soldiers, get back out in the neighborhoods. And then if the Sunnis come up and they want to organize themselves, let them do it. And my goodness, you know, it made such a change, such and so fast it caught everybody off balance. Everybody was saying, oh, the war is lost, and actually the war was well on its way to being won.
Well, I think it was really interesting when you look at that, the people that kind of instigated the whole idea of the surge. I mean, it really, in some cases, according to the book, it didn't really come from the military. It came from Senator Robb and Senator McCain.
McCain, of all the people, and to be fair, of all the people, and when I researched this book over 5 years, who was the most consistent, always, it was Senator McCain. I mean, he understood, and I just admire the man, because when others were dithering or moaning and groaning, he was the most consistent guy. And then when Governor Robb, who had been a Marine and served in Vietnam, when he got out there, he took one look at the actual conditions on the ground, because General Casey sneaked him away and let him go out on patrol.
Okay, I need to take a pause. Hold on to that thought for a second, Bing. We've got to take our last break of the day.
You're listening to a rebroadcast of Veterans Radio, October 18th, 2008. Right here on WDEO 990 AM.
You can help the Army Historical Foundation honor the soldiers of yesterday and today. Go to armyhistory.org to learn how you can help build the National Museum of the U.S. Army. The museum will be the Army's national landmark, preserving the sacrifice of every man and woman who has worn the Army uniform since 1775. Visit armyhistory.org today and honor the Army service of every generation.
We're back on Veterans Radio. We're talking with Bing West, author of the book The Strongest Tribe, War Politics and the Endgame in Iraq. If you have a question, give us a call at 877-573-7825. Bing, we were just talking about how the tide of this war had turned. We decided that, you know, as you pointed out, that we were actually winning the battle in the Anbar province because the locals decided that al-Qaeda shouldn't be there. You know, they try to decide to, you know, that, as you meant, I like the analogy that the mob was in there, you know, taking over and taking their women and marrying them and so on and so forth, and probably taking up all their money as they went along. So what is happening in Baghdad at this time?
Well, but the other factor that I think should be kept in mind about how the war turned, the Sunnis would never have turned if they didn't have somebody to turn to.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, they were intimidated, and there was this wonderful sheikh by the name of Sattar who started their uprising. But Sattar had to be able to turn to somebody. He had no power. And it was turning to the Americans that was critical. And if the Americans had not been out there, if they had been on their bases, if he didn't know who they were, it would never have happened. In other words, it was the fact that the Americans persisted at many times when the troops were saying, we're just banging our heads against the wall.
Mm-hmm.
That was making the difference, and we couldn't see it until the Sunnis decided to shift. Later I said to Sattar, couldn't you have done this 3 years earlier and saved us all this grief on both sides? And he was a thoughtful guy. Al-Qaeda finally killed him, unfortunately. But before they did, you know, he thought about my question. And then he said to me, no, he said, we Sunnis had to convince ourselves you couldn't convince us, meaning we had to go through that pain of fighting, and they had to. But if we hadn't been out there, if you know, right. he would have had nobody to go come over to.
Right.
Now, in Baghdad, there was nobody to come over to because the Americans had left. They were on the bases. And what happened there was that the Shiite police with the Shiite militia were going out in what were called the death squads. Night after night, they would go to any neighborhood, and they knew exactly which neighborhoods, you know, the Sunni neighborhoods.
Right.
And they would shoot their weapons at the houses, and then they would yell at the people, "We're giving you 3 hours to get out, or we're going to burn you out." And then they'd wait, and they were forcing the people. You'd see them. They're walking down the streets at 2 o'clock in the morning carrying their pitiful possessions, anything they could drive with or carry on their backs, and that was it. Anything else had to stay. And then you'd go into the houses, and the American soldiers brought me in, and you'd see the food still on the table and pretty nice houses on the inside. And the American soldiers would say to me, "And, sir, if we come back here in 2 days, it'll be gone." And you'd see moving trucks driving up and loading the furniture with the police, and then they'd drive away, and they'd sell it somewhere. And then a week later, you'd end up with a Shiite family in this house paying $7 a month rent to the Shiite militia. So the Shiite militia became their own mafias.
Right. Oh,
now, what broke that was really another story, and that took about another year.
Mm-hmm.
First, Petraeus and General Odierno went after al-Qaeda with the Sunnis on their side. And then only after they had al-Qaeda on the run did they turn around and go after the Shiite militia.
Right. We have a question from one of our listeners, Vance from Ann Arbor. Welcome to the Veterans Radio.
Hi. Good morning, Dale. Good morning, Bing. How can one get your book? I hope Amazon.com, or if your local bookstore doesn't have it, jump up and down 3 times and say, "You don't have that bestseller." I'll do that. It did make it's up to number 11 on the New York Times bestseller list.
Good. And we're going to put a link. We have a link to Amazon on our website, and we'll get the name of the book up there. So, yeah, you can go to Amazon, all the other bookstores. I think I got my copy through Amazon myself. And it is. It's a great book to read, and I think that all those of you out there will really learn a lot by reading this. It was very enlightening to me. It got rid of a lot of ideas that I had about, you know, what caused, who caused, and how, so forth. You mentioned, let's get back to Baghdad, that prior to Petraeus coming there, that the American troops had moved out into their FOBs, is that what they call them?
Correct. But they're
giant,
just bases.
Giant bases.
Huge bases, yeah.
And
I'll tell you, that worries me. I mean, we got there. Look, we have succeeded in Iraq. Now, any listener can say, "My goodness gracious, what's your definition of succeeding?"
Right.
And I'd simply say, not losing. And that means, you may say, "What are you talking about?" I'd say, simple. Nothing good ever happens to a loser or to a quitter. And we didn't quit, and we weren't beaten. And that makes a huge difference. But it doesn't mean that we're going to have a shining city on a hill that's an example for the rest of humankind. Prime Minister Maliki is very sectarian. He's overconfident. But the big problem we're now working with is politics. We're not working with a military problem anymore. There is no more fighting in Iraq. The fighting basically is over because our troops did such a good job and hung in there. The irony of the situation that we're not getting credit for, I get really angry at people like the New York Times that they don't really tell people the actual fact, and the basic fact is that because of the decency of our troops and the toughness of our troops, combining both, we've gotten to the point where the Sunnis who are fighting us don't want us to leave the country.
Mm-hmm.
we're the only people at the grassroots level. The American sergeant and the American lieutenant are the ones who are trusted most by everybody on the streets. You can't walk down a street in Fallujah or Haditha or Baghdad without the average person coming up to you, Sunni or Shiite, with some complaint about something.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, the irony is everyone trusts the Americans. That's the great irony. Now, Maliki would like to get us out of there because he now wants to kind of put his stamp on things his way and get reelected and take the credit. Typical politician.
Right.
And we just have to be real careful not to try to say we did too much, because in the end, You know, if you really want loyalty, you have to have a dog in Washington. The same, I think, is true in the Middle East. We can't expect that we're going to find politicians thanking us profusely for what we did. I mean, the French, you know, after a while, didn't thank us for liberating them in World War II.
That's true.
So I think we have to recognize we held together something in the center of the Middle East. The oil is flowing. It's better, much better than it was under Saddam. And be satisfied with what we've done.
We got about a minute to go, Bing, and I don't want to mean to stump you here, but what do you think we're going to have to do in Afghanistan?
Afghanistan is much tougher, and the biggest problem with Afghanistan is that you don't have something like the Sunni tribe. Once the Sunnis decided to come over, they all swung over, but they swung over to the Americans. The problem is we have nothing like that in Afghanistan. The big problem with Afghanistan is that we're building up the Afghanistan army because that's what our army does, but we know the problem is at the police level. We're not really on top of that inside Afghanistan, and we have this huge border, and the Taliban and al-Qaeda and Osama bin Laden are on the other side of the border. They're in western Pakistan.
Mm-hmm.
So the next president of the United States has a tougher problem dealing with Pakistan-Afghanistan than we had in Iraq.
Well, Bing West, I want to thank you so very much for being on Veterans Radio. His book is called The Strongest Tribe, and I really recommend to all of you get an opportunity to read this book. It will really open up your eyes as to what I think really happened over there and what's still happening over there. And I have to thank you so much for the credit that you've given to the American soldier. I mean, in spite of all of the flare-ups that occurred over there where the press goes nuts and saying how evil and bad we are, you know, 99% of those men and women have done an amazing job.
Well, they turned it. This war turned from the bottom up.
Right.
It really did. It really did. And I'd like to thank Bob for giving me an opportunity to explain, you know, how Sister Bunny gave me the name Bing.
Thank you. Thank you for being on the program, Bing.
Thank you,
very
Bob.
Much.
Thank you, Dale.
You're listening to Veterans Radio Live right here on WDEO 990 AM. Stay tuned after this very important message, and we'll be right back with Dale Live with Bing West.
You have honorably served the United States and the Marine Corps in times of peace and war. Now we would like to serve you. The Marine Scholars Program covers the total cost of attending Ave Maria University. By combining resources from the Ave Maria University Marine Scholars Funding, federal financial aid entitlements, and the GI Bill, the benefits are granted for the duration of the recipient's study at Ave Maria University, contingent upon good conduct and good academic standing. The Marine Scholars Program is open to all reserve and active component Marines and other combat veterans of Operation Enduring Freedom and Operation Iraqi Freedom who have honorably served our country. Please visit us online at www.avemaria.edu or call the Assistant Director of Admissions at 239-280-2552. You helped us. Now let us help you. Semper Fi.
And we're back on Veterans Radio Live, coming to you from the studios of WDEO in Ann Arbor, Michigan. And we've just finished replaying a program that we did in October of 2008 with Bing West. And joining us now live on the line is Bing West. Bing, welcome back.
Thank you.
It's such a pleasure to talk to you now in hindsight, looking back 5 years, about how accurate your story was and your guesses as to what might happen in the future. Let's take a quick look at where do you think Iraq is today?
As I said 5 years ago, that Maliki was sectarian, cocky, wanted us out of there. I never believed a president of the United States would just quit. And once President Obama just quit, Iraq just deteriorated. And now you have a punk government led by Maliki. You have a the Sunnis are furious with Maliki, and they're furious with us for letting them down, and Iraq is a mess.
And what about Afghanistan?
Well, as I indicated about Afghanistan, I always thought that was crazy. At least in Iraq, if we had kept our promises with the Sunnis, you'd have stability. The problem in Afghanistan is that the major tribe, the Pashtuns, who are supporting the Taliban, want to support the Taliban.
Mm-hmm.
And they have a huge sanctuary 1,500 miles long in Pakistan. So I can't see how Afghanistan turns out well. In all of my books I've indicated that I'm very disappointed in our generals. I think that they were too full of themselves and didn't understand war. And they said that the mission of the military, of our soldiers, was to be nation builders. Well, no, it's not. We don't know how to build Detroit. You can't turn to the United States Army, the United States Marine Corps, and say, go forth and build an Islamist nation. I mean, in the middle of the Middle East, our generals... We've walked away saying our generals did a good job and we love our generals. And I'm on the other side. I'm very disappointed in our general officer leadership.
All of the books that I've read, including yours and your son's, about what was going on in Afghanistan have a similar tone to them. It's just like you're constantly putting yourself, these are our soldiers, constantly putting themselves at risk and putting them in harm's way, and nobody is able to support them and are not able to follow up on anything. Because it doesn't seem like the Afghan military is willing to follow through. You know, once we've secured an area, they're not able to hold it. And I realize that they're getting better. I'm not trying to besmirch the entire Afghan army, but it sounds so familiar.
The basic problem that I see is very simple. I had a combined action platoon with Vietnamese in Vietnam. And that system worked. But that system, to put it bluntly, was colonial. In Vietnam, when we were working in a village with the farmers and we made a militia, mm-hmm. we selected the leaders. The problem that we've had in Iraq and Afghanistan is that we've told them, we've given you freedom. And therefore you have your own leaders, and we won't do anything about that. We'll become, if anything, your servants. So we will not change who's in charge on your side, but we'll do the fighting. Now, when you put it in that blunt way, the average American would say, what?
Mm-hmm.
I'm not going to do that, but that's exactly what we've done. The problem I saw time after time in Afghanistan is that we would have a police chief who was sexually molesting 10-year-old boys. Something just gross. And we could do nothing about it because we couldn't fire bad officers and we couldn't promote good officers. So when I look at all the problems we have, it gets back to that. If you go to a country where they're losing on the battlefield, and you don't have the authority to take control, then don't go and fight their war for them. And I'm just flabbergasted that even through today, and we're finished fighting now, we're out of there now,
mm-hmm.
But we never said, we're going to find the bad officers and fire them.
Well, yeah, somebody's got a clean house, and it's unfortunate that it doesn't look like we're the ones doing it. I wanted to ask you about an article that I read that you and Dakota Meyer wrote in the Washington Post. And this, again, goes back. You know, history just keeps repeating itself, it seems. Well, we're not letting these Afghani or Iraqi nationals who helped us into our country. We're keeping them out, and it's another promise that we've broken. Could you comment on that just briefly?
Sure. Every single American platoon in Iraq and Afghanistan had an interpreter some entrepreneurial young Iraqi or Afghan who watched soap operas on television and learned enough English, pidgin English, to get along. And they volunteered to be with us. But what happens? They get with that platoon, American platoon, and they're with them for a year. And by the time a year has passed, they think they're American. They've been with the Americans the entire time. They've adapted their way of speaking. They've adapted their way of thinking. They're us. And they go out on patrol, and they just think they're Americans. And all of a sudden, the American platoon goes home, and they say, "Don't worry, Abdul. You know, we're going to get you the papers to come here to the United States." Well, that should be automatic. But no, it isn't. We'll allow any Saudi to come here to the United States, anyone from Yemen, that sort of thing. But anybody from Iraq or Afghanistan has to pass through mysterious security councils somewhere in Washington. And they allow in only 10% of everyone who's nominated by platoon commanders. And what we've done is we've set up a bureaucratic system that has an incentive to say no and no incentive to say yes, and we're leaving these guys behind to die.
Because they've
given their loyalty to us, and everyone knows it.
Mm-hmm. Yes, I was going to say, we've signed their death warrant when we don't let them come.
Correct.
To get them out. I just don't understand that. As I was reading that and preparing for the program today, I was, just found myself getting angrier and angrier again. I wish that somebody would, you know... You need to think of a political career, although that probably wouldn't be much fun because then you don't want to do that.
Well, you can see what's happened.
Oh, absolutely.
There were two Iraqis in 2010. They weren't interpreters, but they were Iraqis. They were living in Denver someplace. And they bought some rifles and sent them to Al-Qaeda.
Mm-hmm. Now,
so immediately the entire bureaucracy says, uh-oh, if you let in any Iraqi or Afghan and he does something wrong and your signature was there for giving him the visa, you're the ones going to go before Congress about sloppy, you know, safeguards and that you've jeopardized Americans.
Mm-hmm.
So we've set up a system that guarantees that a bureaucrat has a terrific incentive never to sign his name and allow anyone in. My proposition has been, if an American general is willing to sign for an Iraqi or an Afghan, that should be good enough. And I know our generals would sign for them, but they're not allowed to. It goes to the State Department group who have no firsthand knowledge of these interpreters and how brave they are.
No, it just seems ridiculous that they, you know, again, nobody wants to take responsibility, but when they do, they won't let you.
Correct.
So, all right. The last thing I wanted to talk about, you know, you are our resident expert on the Middle East, and you've been writing some comments recently about Syria, and everybody's getting a little nervous about what's going to happen there. What is your take on that?
Oh, gosh. You know, I'm a Marine, and basically I want to support the Commander-in-Chief and just say, aye, aye, sir.
Mm-hmm.
But President Obama, unfortunately, doesn't want to be a commander-in-chief. He doesn't want to lead, and he makes that so obvious.
Right.
Going on nationwide television and saying he's weary of war, you just don't do that if you're the leader. And basically saying to Putin, and Putin, you know, who's the president of Russia, sneers at our president, and saying to Putin, thank you very much for stepping into Syria and helping me out of this jam that I got myself into by saying I was going to attack and then I really didn't want to attack. Well, the biggest problem that he has in the Middle East now that we have is that our closest allies, Jordan and Saudi Arabia, don't trust us.
Mm-hmm.
And Russia has been made our equal in the area, which hasn't been true since 1973. So unfortunately, every move the president is making, it's a move to say, I don't want to be out here. I don't want to be involved. And people get that. Mm-hmm. And then they don't involve you anymore. But it's you can't just walk away from the entire region. You have to learn how to play your cards smartly, and we just aren't doing that.
So what do you think is going to happen with this voluntary, getting rid of their gas and stuff?
Oh, I think that's a lot of baloney. I mean, the truth is that Assad has been given a lifeline to stay in power for quite some time. But chemicals aren't the issue. They really aren't. Chemicals in World War I killed about 4% of everybody who was a casualty. So they make it's horrendous. It's a horrendous 4%, but it's 4%. And the same thing is true in Syria. Over 100,000 died. Maybe 1,400 from chemicals. You compare that with a nuclear weapon, and you're talking an apple and an orange. The biggest problem that we face isn't the chemical weapon. It's that Iran is dead set on getting a nuclear weapon. And the president has said he's not going to allow that. But now everyone thinks he probably is going to allow it. And that puts Israel in the position of sort of saying, am I going to attack by myself? Mm-hmm. And this is going to play out about 6 months to a year from now. There's going to be a showdown one way or the other about a year from now with Iran. And right now we're not showing that we're strong enough to stop Iran from developing a nuclear weapon. And if Iran gets a nuclear weapon, they become the toughest country in the Middle East, and they're no friends of ours.
That's true. They would become the strongest tribe in the area, and it's unfortunate that we've kind of given up that role. And, you know, we don't want to be the policeman for the world, but I think, you know, we have to keep our promises, and it's just like anybody else. You know, if you don't keep your promises, you don't trust them anymore.
I can see a punitive strike where really American lives, because we're so powerful, are not at risk, and you gain something because you did it, and you don't make a big deal of it. But this talk, and then backing off isn't the right thing to do. Certainly we don't want to be the policeman of the world anymore. We learn from these, but we can do enough to keep our own interests strong, like President Reagan did. President Reagan didn't involve us in big wars, mm-hmm. but no one challenged President Reagan.
That's true. And unfortunately, we've run out of time again, Bing. And I just want to thank you so very much for being on Veterans Radio and sharing your opinions with us. And we'll be in touch, because I think our audience really needs to hear what you've got to say.
Well, I certainly appreciate and I consider it an honor to be able to talk with you. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Bing. We'll be talking with you again. We'll be back next week live on Veterans Radio. Let us know if you've got some programs you'd like to hear again, and we'll contact those people and get them back on the air and see if we can catch up. Until next week, you are dismissed.